The Right Question is funded by the Steele Reese Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
How many parts are in your novel?
There are 144 very short chapters. The shortest one is one sentence, and the longest one is three pages. And the reason there are 144 is because I have always thought in 12s, which I say in the book I hope has to do more with moons and months and less to do with the apostles. But for whatever reason, things come to me in 12s. So I wanted to write a book where there was 12 times 12 things coming together. And I did.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features interviews with writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking this time with Pam Houston. We'll be talking about her latest book, which is a novel titled Contents May Have Shifted. One reviewer described Contents May Have Shifted as, quote, a Mexican jumping bean of a book with more than 132 segments dispersed across the world. And then there are 12 airplane segments, so that makes 144, which I thought was a really great description for how I experienced the book. So why don't you tell us a little bit about why you chose such an unconventional presentation?
Well, the book was born when I was invited to the Wisconsin Book Festival in Madison and was asked to be a part of an evening called Unveiled. And the form of the book really speaks to my process because I had a very short time to write something that I was going to have to read in public. And the way I have made all my books is by casting back in my memory to things in the world that really arrested my attention. I call them glimmers, even though they're not necessarily pretty, but things that said, hey, writer, over here, pay attention to this. And because I only had a very short time to write this thing that I was going to read in Madison, Wisconsin, about 48 hours to write it, I simply did that. I chose 12 little mini scenes, these glimmers, the way I experience the world, the way I try to take Henry James' advice and try to be a person on whom nothing is lost, and just put them in order, in a random order, as I remembered them. 12 little mini scenes of something interesting that happened, and believed that they would cohere a certain amount just because they all came through the conduit of me. And I thought of them on a particular day, and I noticed them. You know, this is the way I think exterior landscape reflects interior landscape. And in fact, they did. They made a kind of little arc, these 12. And I read them that night, and Richard Bausch, a writer who I admire a lot, was there, and he said, write 100 of those. And, you know, he loved the form. And, you know, I've always thought that the meaning that gets made associatively between unrelated objects, you know, there's a kite in the air on the beach that reminds you of your mother's red sweater, that reminds you of a cheesesteak hoagie on the boardwalk in New Jersey, whatever that is, that sort of gut association can be more powerful and more interesting and more, in a certain way, accessible to a reader on a gut level than meaning that gets made logically or chronologically. So I thought, well, what if the whole book were linked associatively like a poem rather than chronologically like a novel? There's a lot of books that are made out of little pieces. I didn't invent the form, but I had a lot of fun writing in it. And it is, it's my inclination. You know, a lot of the other stories in the other books or even the novel Sighthound was made more or less this way. It was like I took all the pieces and then I put them in a more logical order or a more chronological order. But it's the way I write no matter what I'm writing. And I try not to spend a lot of time writing what might be thought of as like the connective material because I find that dull. You know, for me, it's like go to the heat, write it, go to the spot where it hurts, the bruise that you can push on, and then get out and go to another one, go to another spot that's hot in some way, you know, either because you happen to be lucky enough to witness a Tibetan sky burial or because, you know, your father broke your leg when you were four. Like, what? Like, where's the hot spot? And sometimes it's just simply the way the light's reflecting on the surface of the water or a momentary conversation overheard in a coffee shop. But what that resonant feeling between that thing in the outside world and something in me is how I know that it's writing worthy for me and that it's going to help me tell a story, even though I don't yet know what the story is.
I don't think I've ever come across a book, though, that had 12 sections all about airplanes.
Right. No, that's true. And the way I describe that to myself, the way I made sense of that while I was writing, is that there's 132 sections that take place someplace, like Gulfport, Mississippi, or Ban Zhanghai, Laos, or Juneau, Alaska. And then there are 12 chapters that occur every 12th chapter that take place no place, which is on an airplane in the sky. And I spend an awful lot of time in airplanes. I'm a million-mile flyer on United now, and I fly over 100,000 miles a year, and I'm fascinated with that as space, you know, as space and non-space, and the way we live and just the simple fact of these businessmen that are just crossing the globe all the time and what we do up there and how we think up there and what we're afraid of up there. All of that is always interesting to me because it's a space I spend so much time in. And the other thing that this reveals is like my secret love of math, you know, and the kind of Rubik's Cube nature of this book and the way it was sort of a math problem to solve. It became very interesting to me by virtue of its structure. And whenever I'm writing a book, I always think, oh, well, I might have to let go of this structure. You know, I create the structure, in this case, these 144 boxes to fill, as a way to feel safe. I just have to fill 144 boxes. I don't have to write a novel. I don't have to think about a plot. I don't have to think about personal growth. I just have to have 144 little significant moments and then get them in the right order. That's a way to feel safe. And often the form that I make for a book, and I've made a similar, you know, not, I've made some kind of form for all my books, it breaks eventually in the writing and things elongate or it becomes more recognizable as a novel. And I thought that might happen here. I thought, oh, well, you know, I'll start out with this idea of 144, but eventually I'm just going to have to get over it and write a novel. But that it held pleased me. And I knew that some people wouldn't like it because it is a Mexican jumping bean, you know, and, you know, all you have to do is read my Amazon review and, you know, my Amazon reviews, then a lot of people don't, but a lot of people really do. And I think that's because, like I said, we feel these associations, the unexpected connection. You know, we feel those, I think, more deeply than the expected ones or the linear ones, which is why I love poetry.
Did you put them in a certain order right off the bat, or did you switch them around, the chronological orders of the little storylines that are running through?
I'm sort of an obsessive reviser, and I can't say, you know, that every single one of these 144 pieces were in every single of the 144 positions, but it's something like that. I wrote the groups of 12, you know, one group at a time with the idea that there would be more talking, more metaphorical repetition within each 12 than without. And that, I think, is true ultimately. You know, like these 12 are full of pelicans, and these 12 are full of alternative religions, and these 12 are full of politics. You know, I had like sort of thematic ideas for each 12, not that they were really about that, because they were all about moving Pam, the narrator, someplace and getting her home. But I had ideas about what each 12 were. But then in the last couple of years of revision, all bets were off, and I moved pieces. You know, what happened was that I was afraid that it wouldn't work. I was afraid that in the end I would have 144 pieces of nothing, you know, really pretty pieces of nothing. And so for the first couple years I was writing, I spent a lot of time telling myself, oh, there is no meaning, and the only true narrative is a shattered narrative, and nobody ever learns or grows in life anyway. I told myself these nihilistic things that I don't believe, so that I wouldn't be afraid to keep writing. Writing's really all about, you know, talking yourself out of fear, I think. The older I get, the more I think that's just the whole ball of wax right there. But then once I knew I had something, once I knew that they were going to add up in a certain way or enough for me, you know, enough to satisfy me, then I let what I think of as that kind of sleeping dragon of narrative arc rise. And so the tail end of the rearranging was really about putting it in an order that let her growth, Pam's growth, become evident, you know, so that it did have an arc. It did have a traditional arc, the ghost of a traditional arc, under all this sort of minor jumping around, kind of like a slinky, you know. A slinky spins and spins and spins and spins, but it still gets somewhere. It gets from one end of the slinky to the other if you trace its shape.
Well, let's talk about this narrator, Pam.
Yes.
I know you've had many questions about the narrator, Pam. The narrator, Pam, has the same name as the writer, Pam, mm-hmm. the author, Pam. Yet it says on the front of the book, a novel.
I have always written autobiographically, and that's really more a function of the way my work gets made. You know, the way my work gets made is I go out in the world and I pay really strict attention to things. I don't sit at home imagining worlds and imagining characters. I pay really close attention to the things I see and smell and taste, and then I come home and I write them down. That's what I do. That's how I've made all my books. What that means is that often I am a character in my own books, you know, a version of me. But when I went to graduate school, the only options were fiction and poetry. You know, nonfiction wasn't a genre that people studied to become. So as I understood fiction, or at least as I understood what my career as a fiction writer was going to be, it was going to be taking these things from the world and shaping them in a way that sometimes involved changing what really happened and sometimes didn't. But shaping them, putting them down next to lots of other things that created a story by virtue of bringing all these odd objects that attracted my attention together. Whether or not it really happened to me was irrelevant to me, or whether or not the very germ of it happened to me and I sort of built a story out of it, or whether or not I cut 2 days out of a 5-day river trip in a story because those 2 days were boring, you know, like the realness of it, the whether this really happened in the real world was completely irrelevant. I didn't care, you know, and the fact that that is the thing that everybody cares so much about now is interesting to me because I don't believe that was true 25 years ago. This book we decided to call a novel quite late in the game, and it was really just an evaluation of how many liberties I had taken with the truth and the way the truth police are very activated in this decade. And so it seemed better to call it a novel because then the conversation about the book all the time wouldn't be, oh, well, you say that you were in Sydney for 3 days, but someone looked up your plane records and you were really in Sydney for 5 days. Like, it just felt safer and better to call it a novel because I honestly don't know how you would write something that was 100% true, even if you tried. You know, I think, I mean, one of the reasons that we're in this lifelong unrequited love with language is because it won't quite mean what we want it to. That's why we're always reaching after it. I think memory is faulty. I think our desires to have been a little different than we are get in our way of storytelling. You know, you can see something really amazing happen on the way home, and it's better by the time you get home and tell your significant other about it. That's just, we are storytellers. I am a storyteller. So is this essentially my story? Yes. Did these things happen to me? Did I go to all these places? Was I in crash position in airplanes all these times? Yes, absolutely. But I'm a shaper of story. If my publisher had said, no, let's call this one a memoir, I would have said, okay. You know, and then whatever, you know, Oprah might have been mad. I mean, who knows what would have happened? It wouldn't have been untrue to call it a memoir. It might have been slightly truer to call it a novel because of the way I shape story. But, you know, there is at this moment in history a big law against fudging the truth in a memoir. And as far as I know, there is no law against writing the truth in fiction. So that's why we went that way. And it's fine with me. I have a lot to say on this subject. And just if you're interested, I wrote an essay called Corn Maze that's really about this moment that we're living in and why we might be so obsessed with the truth and this truth we can't get at. So if you're interested, it's easily found on the internet. But those are basically my thoughts about it as it relates to this book.
I think that's why we stuck the tag on it, creative nonfiction.
Well, see, even that is problematic to me. I go to an accountant called Creative Accounting, and everybody knows what that means.
Uh-huh.
You know, it means creative accounting, wink, wink. So what is creative nonfiction means? It means, oh, we're just cheating. We're cheating, you know. But that isn't what it means to the creative nonfiction people. In fact, Lee Gutkind, who coined the phrase, I believe, originally, is the most adamant of all that there shouldn't be any shady stuff, you know. But the word memoir, which is a word I like, even though it doesn't apply, of course, to all creative nonfiction, the word memoir, like the very Frenchness of it, like suggests shadow, doesn't it? Like it suggests, oh, well, memoir, you know, like you can just hear somebody, you know, sort of bending the truth in it, in the very word. I can't, anyway.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Pam Houston about her novel Contents May Have Shifted. And you'll find a link to the essay Pam mentioned a few minutes ago at therightquestion.blogspot.com. That's right with a W. After a short break, she'll read from the book. Stay tuned. Let's hear you read something. Let's hear one of the airplane pieces.
Okay. I think I'll read Laos, the Laos airplane. Most of the chapters are titled For the Place They Take Place, Davis, California, Santa Cruz, Argentina. But the airplane stories are titled with the flight number. So this is QV, which is Laos Air 905. I am looking out the rounded rectangle of the plane window, at the right-hand tire at the bottom of two triangular struts that descend diagonally from the wing. Laos Air likes these planes with the high wings, I know, because they don't need much space to take off or land. On the tire I am looking at, there is a giant X of duct tape, which on closer examination I see is actually a patch on top of a patch, an older X of duct tape beneath it. Look at that, I say to the Laotian beside me. We have already established that he speaks English. In fact, a few minutes ago he told me our flight to Pansavan is 7 hours late because the drug lords up in Chiang Rai needed to borrow the plane. He said it with the type of smile on his face he might have worn if he were telling me his grandmother had baked him some cookies. Now he nods his head at the tire in a similar kind of affirmation. He is well-dressed and studious-looking, a thick book on his lap, possibly a government official. That, he says, is no problem. It looks like a problem, I say. No, no, he says. The correct way to land this plane is the left side first, then the nose, then the right side. 1, 2, 3, he says, making his hand into a little airplane. No problem with that one there. Yesterday, in the relative safety of the tea house, Zai said, Lao Aviation has a new director now. The old director is in, he paused for a minute, trying, I assumed, to remember the English word. Jail, I offered, but the answer was Bangkok. On Laos Air, none of the tray tables stay attached to the back of the seats, and few of the seats stay in a forward-locked position. Somewhat more disturbingly, the cabin is not sealed, so soon after takeoff, when we hit some perfect combination of altitude and dew point, clouds of steam come rolling down from the overhead bins and fill the cabin. This is the point when the Westerners always scream, because to the untrained eye, the steam looks a lot like smoke. But this is my third flight on Laos Air, which makes me an old hand. Today, when the steam starts billowing in, a blonde woman in her 60s, German, I think, two rows in front of me, grabs the flight attendant's arm in alarm. Air conditioning, the flight attendant says, as she must every single flight, without so much as cracking a smile. The Chinese have the contract to service these planes, says the Laotian beside me, when we have reached whatever altitude is required to cause the steam to clear. But our government cannot pay them money, and so they do not service the planes. I think this would not happen in your country. I think it would not, I say. Some of these planes have not been serviced probably for 3 to 5 years. Hence the duct tape, I say, but I don't think he understands. What do the Chinese care about some dead Laotians, he asks. And there is that off-to-grandmother's-house smile again as the plane lurches suddenly forward and begins its steep descent.
I read some of these and I go, why would you ever fly 3 times on a Laotian plane? Do you have a death wish? Coincidentally, not too long ago, I heard about the sky burials that take place in Bhutan. And then I read the chapter in your book about it, and I'd like you to read it and just say what you were doing there and how you happened to go witness this amazing event.
Well, I went to Tibet because I was broken up with a note, and going to Tibet seemed like an excellent response to that. And because I've done quite a bit of travel writing for magazines, I've met sort of the best outfitters in a lot of countries, especially in Asia. So because they know me and they know I'm serious about my traveling and serious about my writing, I was given special permission to attend a sky burial. I think it's a little easier to get that now. At the time I did it, it was very unusual, as the chapter will reveal. 57, Drigung, Tibet. Shring and Haley and I follow an old lama to the top of a bald hill above the monastery in the cool morning air. We have been told there will be 3 corpses, a man, a woman, and a child, and that they are unrelated, though they appear to us like a little family, laid out on the platform, wrapped in their cotton shrouds. We are very lucky, Shring says, many corpses today. When he says corpse, it sounds like copse, as in pines. The man who will prepare the bodies arrives and begins to unwrap the first corpse. A little ways up the hill, roughly 100 vultures jockey for position against a rope held in place by family members of the deceased. They are wild birds, but Drigung is the most accessible monastery practicing sky burials. The birds know to come at 11 a.m. for their almost daily feed. Shring told us the bodies would be quartered, but the word filleted is the one that jumps to mind. He explains that the man with the big knife will make 4 incisions, 1 around the chin, 1 down the center of the torso, and 2 at a diagonal down the shoulder blades. They pull the skin off the bones, he says, because if they don't give the vultures the bones first, they sometimes eat the flesh and leave the bones, and then the whole person doesn't ascend together, and there is more work for the butchers to pound the bones into pulp. He hesitates enough over the word butcher that I know he is not quite happy with it, but he doesn't know a better one. These men, he says, that do the cutting, they are not allowed to marry. Their karma is very bad. Same with the men who butcher animals. Do you mean this job is punishment for their last life, I ask him, or that they will be punished for this job in the next life? Yes, he says. Also jewelers. It is the same. Jewelers, I say, why? It is just what we believe, he tells me. Is it because they are wealthy, I ask? It is just what we believe, he says again. All three bodies are cut into pieces, and I miss whatever sign the Lama gives to the men who have been holding the rope. When the vultures run in, the smell takes up all the air on the mountaintop, and as they rush past me, I can see they are huge birds, each of them half the size of a man. There is squawking and shrieking. Several birds go after one femur. Another makes off with a forearm, the hand, with all the flesh still on it, bouncing along the stones at my feet. No fewer than six birds are pulling in different directions on a skull that is still attached to a spine, that is still attached to one leg, and the skull is laughing. The old llama plays tug of war with a vulture over a leg bone, and when he wins, he lifts another vulture, this one nearly featherless, out of the melee and gives him what is left of the bone. That is a sick one, Shring says. Every so often, the butcher picks up an especially aggressive vulture by its head and hauls it off to the side. When there is nothing left but skulls and pelvises, the butcher steps back in and pounds the big bones into pulp with a giant mallet. Bone pulp flies all over the place, and a huge wad of it lands on Shring's arm. In seconds, a member of the family of the deceased comes over with a little bottle of alcohol and wipes it clean for him. His preparedness makes me realize this must happen all the time. Shring smiles at the man out from under his Scooby-Doo hat. On the walk back down the hill, Shring says, "When I see a sky burial, all desire to have money and get more things goes away. Because you see a man, then you see him dead in a ball, then you see him cut to pieces, and in 20 minutes he is nothing. It is like he never existed." Shring picks sage so that we can burn it in the little stupa back at the monastery. When we get there, he shows me how to stick my whole upper body in so that I won't take the bad dead people luck with me back into the world. When I can't see or breathe anymore, I pull my head out, but Denzin grabs me by the scruff of the neck and pushes me back in. "It is very unusual," Shring says, when Denzin finally turns me loose, "a Westerner here at this ceremony." Denzin is afraid that now the car will crash. Denzin holds Haley in the stupa so long I think she will surely asphyxiate. When he finally lets her out, he talks with urgency for several minutes to Shring in Tibetan, and when he's finished, we ask what he said. Shring thinks a long time and says, "Denzin says it is good to be happy all the time." "Really?" Haley says. "All those words?" "And," Shring says, after a pause, "he says it is sometimes also good to be sad."
Pam Houston lives on a ranch in Colorado and in California, where she is director of creative writing at UC Davis. Look for more information about her and her books at therightquestion.blogspot.com, and be sure to spell right with a W. Also at our blog, you'll find book reviews, Monday poems, book lists, and links to our podcast and Facebook page.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau, Lisa Simon, David Moore, and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to author information, audio, and our Facebook and podcast feeds at therightquestion.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.